we're just layering systems for systems' sake. One of those, like, wouldn't it be cool if bleh? And it's like, yeah, but like, I mean, anything would be cool.
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 304 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam. I'm highly caffeinated.
I'm Sam. I'm holding the microphone.
This is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is March 26th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. And before we get started, we do have a warning. There's going to be swears and profanes in this podcast. It's explicit. And also, we'd like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got a new one from Digital Wizard.
Ooh.
But there's no A in there, so it's Wizard, who says, thanks for being such awesome people every week. Special thanks for your discussions around mental health. Your testimonies are part of the reason why I am now successfully treating my ADHD.
Hey, congrats.
Hey.
Didn't even realize I was dealing with it until I talked to a doc. Cheers to you all.
Welcome to the, welcome to being being an adult and not, and nobody knowing what it means to have a brain, you know?
Yep. Yeah, it's a crazy world out there, and we're all just doing our best. So, thanks to our recurring supporters who are donating monthly. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it. All right, let's talk about life. Well, I mean, we got one big news.
What's the big life?
I'm getting shanked in the arm to strengthen my immune system. Woo-hoo-hoo. Getting the COVID vaccine. Today. Well, first part of it. I got two weeks. I got to go back and get the other part.
You're getting the two doser.
Yeah. What a relief. What a relief.
Now you will be let down by one particular thing that no one for some reason has designed, which is the experience after the shot. They're literally like, this is a shot that symbolizes so much for a person, mm-hmm. right? And then they're like, yeah, just go wander around for like 15 minutes. I don't know, buy a snack or something. And, as far as like –
it's very unceremonious.
Yeah, they could do so much.
Well, yeah,
much
like contrast that to like your final chemo, right? Where there's like, there's like a bell you go ring and like the whole – like everybody there like knows what that means. And mm-hmm.
Everybody starts clapping as soon as you slam that bell. Like I almost ripped the thing off the wall. I was like, duh. Yeah.
Well, and not only that, but like – I still do have to come back in 2 weeks, So it's like, it's really drawn out. It's not a very, the emotional impact of the moment does not match the actual thing that's happening in the moment at all. But it's going to be pretty cool. There's always a chance that there's like, that I would have an adverse reaction. I might have some nausea, might even get a slight fever or something for a day. Mm-hmm. I don't give a shit. I don't even give a shit.
Let's go.
It's gonna have a sore doing business.
Yeah, gonna have a sore arm for a weekend. I don't even give a shit. That's just part of it,
Gotta break some eggs.
You gotta break some eggs to have a sandwich, whatever. Very excited about it, and I'll talk more about it. But yeah, I gotta go driving like an hour and a half to go get it, and then hour and a half back, and then I gotta do that again in 2 weeks. So,
a little road trip.
It's just a thing, but worth it. So let's talk about Crashlands 2.
Yeah.
Lots of interesting philosophical stuff, sort of shook out this week with, our work on Crashlands 2. So last week we talked about environments, how we had spent quite a bit of time working on the tile set and, adding all these little extra bits of like flair to the world to make it feel more alive and like cool, like sunlight dappling in the environment. But the thing that has literally just been sitting there for all of development is the water. Mm-hmm. It's just been sort of a flat blue sheet.
Yep.
And the reason that it had been sitting there is because we kind of knew like this is a big project. And it's also the case that we kind of felt like the water needed an environment to be sort of in.
Yeah, water's not water, super interesting.
Water's kind of nothing. Mm-hmm. Like it's an invisible moving, it's transparent. So Water is really all about the environment that it's in, like what kind of light is it reflecting, you know, all of that stuff.
What does it reveal underneath?
If it yeah, is there stuff under the water? And it just kind of never felt like the right time, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, which was also true in original Crashlands, and that just carried all the way through to launch.
It was just kind of never the right time. Yeah. So this week, it was the right time. And Sam and I spent a lot of the week just digging through all kinds of YouTube videos for all kinds of games, looking at what their water is, what it looks like, looking up tutorials for all kinds of like game engines, seeing like how do people think about making water in 3D? How do they think about making it in 2D? How do people do it in Godot? How do they do it in Unity? How do they do it in Game Maker? Finding out that none of those things were doing the thing that we needed or wanted.
As is always the case somehow.
Yeah. But, you know, we were able to kind of scrape together enough concepts that we could adapt them to what we wanted to do. And oh boy, I think it's working. We got it. We got water effects in the game and it feels great. It's
pretty dope.
I'd say it's about 80% of the way to where I would like it to be, which is dramatically farther than zero, which is where it has been. And it's good enough already that actually I had gotten – so, you know, we have our deployment pipeline. So whenever we put out a patch for our internal QA, then like it goes out into Android and, you know, wherever else like internally so we can test it on different devices. So this morning I just got up. And while I was eating my toast in the morning, I just walked out onto a peninsula in Crashlands 2 and just stared out across the ocean and just watched the sunrise. Yeah. And the thing is, like, we don't have any kind of like powerful sunrise effects happening yet with relation to the water or anything. But it was just kind of a nice, mm-hmm. It was just kind of a nice moment. And then I kind of came into the morning meeting all like fired up and I was like, we got to have wave sounds. If you get next to an ocean, whatever the hell that means, we got to figure out how to like make it sound like you're next to an ocean, you know? But then we had a short discussion like, well, what's the difference between a swamp and an ocean? Like a swamp shouldn't have a bunch of wave, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other can of worms. But but just to kind of zoom out now about like, why, you know, what's the point of doing all this stuff?
Well, I think it all kind of, yeah, I think the why around water is one of the most interesting ones because there are very few games where water is actually like the core mechanic in some way. And yet people tend to spend a lot of time on water, on making it look good. And so, yeah, the question is, why would you do that? What's going on there? Really, because this has nothing to do with
it. It's kind of the quintessential what's the word? It's like just purely trying to develop immersion. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. all that it's trying to do. And that really is the why. It's if you're trying to create a world, if there's water in that world, the water should be water.
I think it's kind of like mm-hmm. I think it's kind of like the human face problem, right? Where if you're going to have a human face in there, there's like you can go style. There's like all kinds of stuff that you can do, right? But if it's a human face, people are really good at like trying to parse a human face and convert that into like, oh, that's hideous, or oh my god, that's scary, or like, oh, that looks mm-hmm. so real, or oh, that's an uncanny valley, or whatever. We're just really good at processing faces, right?
Yeah.
And so when you have faces, then you have to make these like early, you have to make these decisions in your design about what do I want the experience of somebody looking at this face to be? Because a face like takes way more of your computational cycles in your brain than like anything else that's happening on screen, right? That's just like how our brains work. And I think water is like similar for environments because water is actually, there's something about it where because it just isn't a thing, actually. Like, it's nothing. And it's always the same thing. I'm like a tree. Like, you can make an alien tree. Like, sure, I can buy anything. You throw some weird-ass squiggly thing on there. I'm like, cool, that's a tree. I get it. But the water next to it.
You can make alien water.
You can make alien water. You know? The water can reflect alien stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big pool of liquid.
Well, yeah, importantly, I mean, water is a primal. Think about it. Like, what has been the problem for people most of the time? Having enough freaking water, right?
Yeah, like you have to cities have are water. Built next to water. You want to like people live next to coasts yeah. primarily.
But
you
I think know, it water also, is like it's got it so many. It's got universal rules, right? And simple ones, or seemingly simple ones from like, you know, watching it, right? But like, unlike anything else, again, like, you know, make a tree, like, and even faces, my earlier example, like, doesn't really apply here because you can have alien faces and so on. Like, sure, they catch your attention, but you can buy almost any face, right? Because faces don't really have rules, right? They have like, or they have very sloppy rules for things that you'll accept as a face.
Except for like in the case of Roblox, where the eyes are just way too high on the their heads, and it just creeps. It's always creeped me out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, but it's like, but there's a huge range in there where they can be like, if they were just a little bit lower, but still technically way too high, you'd still buy it, right? There's a lot of, and water is similar because like you can still stylize water, right? But the range of things that like that a viewer will buy, I think is just like
– it's pretty constrained.
It's pretty constrained, yeah. You know?
Yeah. And so it's one of those weird things too where water it becomes more obvious where like how it's missing the mark when you see it moving, when you see it reflecting light or not reflecting light properly or whatever the case may be. And unfortunately, it's very hard to explain.
Yep.
So if you see it and you're talking to somebody about it, it's not like if you have a picture of a tree and you're like, oh yeah, like these branches are just way too skinny or something, you know, like something like that. Like you just point at a thing and say something about it that's obvious. But with water, it's actually a bunch of layers of effects, like moving around and interacting with each other and interacting with the environment. And so being able to easily talk about what is missing from it or what needs to be changed is just very hard to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It takes a lot of iteration.
And everything is subtle, like all of it. You can't
it's
like,
all very subtle.
You can't just be like, this mouth should be twice as big because then it'll look really a lot meaner. You know, there's like nothing like
water
that.
Doesn't have a mouth. Yeah. It doesn't have anything permanent.
Yeah. It's just like these reflections are moving a little too fast or like sometimes they – like the brightness kind of clusters too much.
Yeah,
sort of, and that seems bad for some reason, but like
the why?
But why? What is it?
Yeah, I think we use our same technique as we've talked about for some of this other stuff where we did a targeting image basically to kind of get this started, which I think actually helped a ton because it broke down. Basically, I had to break down in basically paint what those layers of effects were, which then when we went to implement them, we actually knew what the layers were as opposed to like we had started on the water for like a day before we realized, oh, we actually need to back up and like decide what this looks like and figure out what that is first before we try to do anything because it's too fucking nebulous. Like there's too much vagary going on here. We need to know what the stack is. It's basically it's a post-processing stack, right? Of like,
yep,
here's all the cool stuff that you have to do. And until you get all of them, it's just not going to quite go. And so I think being able to actually bust them out separately into these layers by taking that time to do a targeting image is actually what gave us the ability to like pretty rapidly put it together. I mean, this is like the first time I think that we've made water that like really feels very good.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah. And it's only going to get better because, you know, this is our first draft of it really. Mm-hmm. And as with all things in Crashlands 2, we're going to get to a point where we're like, yeah, this is good. And then 3 months from now, we're going to be like, what is this garbage? And then we're going to find some new thing, spend another week and find a new thing to like really take it up to even another level.
Yeah, but it only gets better from here though, which is, you know, the main thing.
Which is great. Yeah, if it already feels good, then, you know, that's good. And so that kind of then leads into conversation about build mode. So we're wrapping up water. And like while I was digging into all of the technical stuff of trying to build the tech stack to make water in Crashlands 2, Sam was doing a bunch of design work and trying to answer some questions about build mode in Crashlands 2. We've had a lot of ideas about what this might look like and what it might sort of be and how it might be different or the same as original Crashlands. But all of those details are sort of contingent upon sort of a much bigger question about why, right? Like, what's the point? What is build mode sort of emotionally? mm-hmm. at the core of the game. Why do we have it? And what do we want it to feel like in Crashlands 2 to use a feature like this? So, Sam, do you have,
Yeah. I think, I mean, one of the weirdest things about it is actually that as we got the environment sort of ratcheted up to a point where they feel really good, literally like, but the next thing I wanted to do instinctually was just build like I just wanted to build a damn house.
I want to live here.
Yeah. And so I think there's this natural kind of, you know, when you're building a bigger game, like something like Crashlands, and by big, all I'm saying there is not in terms of content, but in terms of systems, right? There's actually a lot of different games going on inside of the game. Then the order of operations that you build those systems through is extremely important and it has a massive impact on all downstream systems. So for example, like focusing on, in our case, getting enough of the player character in combat, enough of the creatures and creature combat done, and then taking this time on the environment has made it so that it's become very apparent that like the next thing that is the most important right thing to do is this, is answering these build mode questions. And importantly, what that means is that build mode is now going to be created in the context created by these previous things we've put together, right? And that seems like the right way, that right order of things that should inform build mode, right? Which is sort of like the environment and the fact that you can be murdered by the environment, essentially by creatures and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And so where we're coming at it from is basically asking the question like, okay, you know, we know what we liked about the original, which is sort of like the ease with which building stuff was a thing. But there was tons of stuff that was really, really bad about it from a mechanical standpoint, as well as just from like its impact on your experience in the world broadly. So people who played the original will know that one key strategy was just to carry like three floors with you so that at any point, if you ran into a body of water, you could just swap into build mode, throw the floors down, walk across it, pick the floors back up, keep going, right? And that's one of those things that we didn't give build mode enough, you know, time, frankly, like in design energy to figure out like what that really meant for the world. And what it meant largely was that there was no way for us, aside from creating a walled outpost, to create a situation where a player could come across an area that they couldn't get into.
They could see it on the periph.
Yeah.
They had to figure out how to get over there using some other interesting game mechanic.
Well, we had to have something like this because of the fact that the world was random.
Yeah. World was procedural. Yeah. So it might have been the case. Like maybe we would design like a super cool outpost, right?
That would just happen to be surrounded by water.
Like, and just by chance on somebody's save, it's just in the middle of a lake and now they just can't go there. So it was kind of and again, like Sam was saying, every game system you make exists in the context of the prior game systems that it, you know, is being stacked on top of. And in our case, with original Crashlands, the first core game system was the idea of procedurally generated worlds. And every other – literally, like every other mechanic that we added in was contingent upon that.
Yeah, it sort of had to pass through that secondary constraint regardless of what the emotional intent was kind of, you know, after the fact.
So when it came down to what it meant to build a base, what it meant to find and fight and tame raise your own creatures, do quests, everything that we did had to run through this filter of, you know, how does this work in a randomly generated world that we don't control the scene, right? And one of the outcomes of that was that we just needed players to be able to walk across any body of water at any time, because we didn't know where they were going to be.
Frankly, like it just
tar anything. Pits,
yeah,
anything. And it was even crazier in stuff like the bog, where what we really wanted was we wanted the water to be like stomach acid. That's why it's green, you know. But nope, you could just. And of course, there's some story elements in there. Like when you fish in the savannah, you get the fat heads or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when you fish in the bog, you get skeletonized fat heads, right? As if to imply like these fish are sort of all over the place in the world, you know?
But somehow they got over here.
They got over here, and then they just sort of melted in the acid, right? But of course, you could still just go ahead and just lay some wood floors right across that acid, and they just stay there forever.
As it's kind of bubbling, because we have this little bubble.
You go across, you go into a tar pit surrounded by turtles. It's bubbling, boiling tar. No problem. Just throw some wood floors on top of it and walk across.
Yeah. So this becomes this big wrinkle for us for questions too, which is like, you want to preserve that that freedom of being able to like find a place where you want to build something cool, right? Where you're like, ooh, this like that feeling in open world games of finding like the right spot, you know, to build your little cabin. That's amazing, right? Super fun. So we want to preserve that, but we also don't want you to be able to just like fucking just walk across any body of water we put out there, because now we've lost the ability to make traversal into an interesting mechanic, because all you do now is just carry your fucking floors with you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But we also don't want you to not be able to do anything interesting with water. So like, exactly. It'd be cool if you could have boats. It'd be cool if you could build a fishing dock, right? And so how do we build a rule set that allows for it to feel like you still can do really cool, interesting stuff and that you actually have a ton of freedom, but with like exactly the right set of limitations that we still are able to do things like use water as a barrier, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that you can technically throw a boat in it. Maybe, right? So like, how do we set up a rule set that allows for that, that also is intuitive and feels like it makes sense, so that we don't have to feel like we need to justify it? Because most things you can get away with not justifying, you know? But if it's that wretched and failure problem, if you allow a player to do too much and then just like stop at some point.
It's too obvious, you know?
It's too obvious. Yeah. So you have to find ways to exactly. You find ways to deal with that.
Yeah. So where this all ends up kind of coming back to is, again, the nice thing about having made the original questions is that we have a lot of context for these design problems. And so really what we want Crashlands 2 to feel like is a game of exploration and adventure that pulls in this sort of settlement building piece to it. And I say settlement in particular because it's not necessarily just about like you. Ideally there's like, you know, NPCs and stuff that can come join you and you can build stuff for them, whatever else. Again, this is all high-level stuff we're figuring out. So,
and none of it exists.
None of it exists. So
these are ideas that we are working toward, but who knows what it's going to end up looking like?
Yeah, but we want to maintain that sense of freedom of where you put your stuff, being able to cross certain gaps with these things. While also, basically, to me, it's transforming the original Crashlands experience, which I would describe as wandering only.
Yeah,
original Crashlands is a game of wandering because
it's wandering coupled with vertical progression. So there's not a wide set of things that you do, right? It's actually narrowed, and you're constantly throwing things away as you move forward, which is like it's propelling you through a wandering exploration journey, right?
Right. Yeah, and you can't really seek in original Crashlands because of the procedural nature of the game, and so the intent is to come up with this basic rule set that actually, you know, adds a bit more physicality to the building process while, again, maintaining a lot of the ease with which you can throw down floors and whatever else for that sort of creative flow thing. And then just enough of these little additional rules to make it so that it feels like, one, this is real stuff that's going down. You're putting it down. And then two, that there are realistic limits that then make it so that the world is actually enriched by the fact that those limits exist. Like that's sort of the tricky bit, right? As far as picking those rules. So for example, being able to put, you know, floors into water, like, yes, you will still be able to do it, but only so far, because actually the water has depth now. You can see it. This is part of the benefit of having this water done to this degree before we start build mode is that you can see the depth, like it's there. It's a very easy thing that for someone could grok and be like, oh yeah, it makes sense. I can't just put like
It's too deep.
It's just too deep.
Yeah. Well, and easy. Not only that, but it's no longer just about, oh, I've made a gold floor, I've made a wood floor, I've made a bone floor. It's a floor is a floor is a floor. I just slap that onto some water, boom. It's like, well, no, what about
Yeah, you're the not fact gonna put floors in the water, you're gonna put a dock.
Yeah, you need to build water. You need to build a structure that's meant to go in the water that has supports, you know, underneath it. Because that's how, you know, stuff works.
Yeah, since we can control that, we can just say like, oh yeah, you can't just put floors in water. Like that's easy. And then we can decide how we present to you the things that you can put on water, right? So right. if we let you build a dock, we could just let you build a dock. Just like literally it's a thing.
Call it a dock.
Yeah. And it just sticks out three tiles. That's just what it does, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. And then boom, there's no question anymore of like there's nothing. There's just nothing. It's just like, no, that's the thing you get to do.
Now that's
you
have a dock, right?
and the alternative would be that, oh, we let you build a dock mounting point, right? And then you can like extend onto it. And then we just have some visual – and then either we could just at some point tell you, oh, it's too long. That's easy. Or
yeah.
we could have some visual representation that the dock changes as it gets longer in a way that makes it feel like it shouldn't be able to get longer at that point or whatever. Yeah. Like we actually have lots of options, but yeah, but the whole like a floor is a floor is a floor and you can slap one anywhere doesn't allow for that. It doesn't allow for us to build in interesting limitations.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's been the ticket is, again, honing in on the emotional questions here, which is like, what is this supposed to feel like? And then again, like you really have to step through a bunch of this weird stuff to – that seems maybe completely like it wouldn't matter per se for the overall game experience. But when you really dig into it, something as simple as like – as basically the question of how far can you put water – or how far can you put floors into water? Can massively affect the shape of the literal like geographical shape of the game world at the end of the day, as well as that player experience of what it feels like to interact with and move through and be challenged by that environment, right?
Yeah. Well, and there's a balance problem here too that we were also talking about as we were kind of thinking through different ways we could do this, which is that for a complex game where there's a lot of sideways progression as well as you know vertical progression. That you want to be open world, so you don't want to have a really strict way in which people interact with things and discover things in a certain order, right? But you still want to be able to gate stuff, right, in various ways. Then you need to have a rule set that is simultaneously like pretty flexible. So like it feels like you can do a lot. But that also allows you as the designer to have a good sense of what the player can do, right? And so if you have a rule, because we entertain the idea of like, what if like over time you can like just build further by you just get better materials or you can get bigger docks or whatever, right? And the consequence of that is that you as a designer now needs to actually pay attention to the question of like, how far could a player build a dock when they get to this point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and then as soon as you want to change something, like add a new dock that can go further or anytime now you change one of those rules because you have this whole concept of like, oh yeah, there's a progression system here. Then now all of a sudden you have to rebalance the entirety of not just the game, but the way the world is designed, right?
You gotta go add the width of every river.
Yeah, the width of every river needs to change. Yeah, so right. So you need to find – so that was the thing we kind of realized was that we need to find – we actually need to have some like really good but meaningful limits that aren't tied to a progression system. And that, you know, but that if we build a simple rule set to make it so that various kinds of progression become possible, but in a very controlled way, that gives us lots of handles. And yeah. since we don't actually know what we're going to do, I'll just like cite one of the examples that we talked about. Because we don't know if we're going to do it, who knows? But the idea of like making it so that you, if we wanted to let you use a boat, right, mm-hmm. that you could. And if in a boat, you could explore a whole body of water, right? But if we only let you get out of the boat and into the boat at a dock.
Because you need to tie it up.
Got to tie it up, right?
I mean,
so now it's simple. So now all of a sudden, we simultaneously give you the ability to like have boats, which is cool, and explore whole bodies of water, right? And discover stuff that you can now see on the shoreline, right? But we take away the boat as a mechanic that makes water meaningless, right? Mm-hmm. So as a
well, and also the boat is just kind of. It's in whatever body of water you constructed it.
Yeah, it's just in there now. Right.
So you're not gonna be able to like drag the boat across the continent to a new river or something.
Yeah. But then now if on the other side of the body of water, like you somehow do get there, right? And then you create or we provide a mechanism to tie up a boat, right? But now all of a sudden we've created a shortcut mechanism, but we didn't give you a shortcut. We just made it so you can create your own shortcut mm-hmm. by putting a boat in the water, right? And yeah. so now all of a sudden, instead of just being like, oh, a path has been built, or oh yeah, once you have a boat, you can just go anywhere. We've now built this interesting system that simultaneously feels like you have a lot of control and a lot of ability to go like explore and do stuff with just enough constraint that we can still, in a way that we understand and that doesn't change, control just when and how you actually can mm-hmm. get across that body of water fully.
Yeah. So there's a lot of dimensions to all this. And again, don't take any of the stuff that we're talking about to mean like this is what we are doing in Crashlands 2.
These are we don't know if we're going to have boats. These are
hypotheticals. Yeah. Because the core of all these questions is to get back to mechanics are not the game. The game is the emotional experience that is generated by the mechanics, right? And so what we're trying to think about is what do we want people to feel like when they play Crashlands 2? And every mechanical decision, every system we layer in is supposed to be in service of that. And if we don't have an answer to that question for any given thing, then we're doing it backwards, right? We're just layering systems for system's sake. One of those, like, wouldn't it be cool if bleh? And it's like, yeah, but like, I mean, anything would be cool. that's not enough. What are we trying to really make people feel? So I think the last little thing to talk about with the Crashlands 2 stuff is this kind of interesting question of goals versus outcomes. And this is something that we've kind of touched on a bit, I think, sort of thematically throughout the life cycle of the podcast and stuff. But one of the conversations we had at the start of development of Crashlands 2, even like when we were like first putting together the high level vision of the game and stuff, is just like, what do we want the reception of this game to be? How do we want the public to respond to this game? And we said that, you know, we want to make a game that is worthy of getting a Game of the Year nomination, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a really, I think, important way to frame that, because we don't decide what games get a Game of the Year nomination.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's also not the it's not specifically the quality of the game that allows for it to happen. Right, because those nominations are a finite resource, right?
Yeah, so there might be 50 games this year that are worthy of it, and 10 will get it, or 5 will get it, depending on who's what award show we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. It depends on who in that moment is looking at it. So 1 year there might be a different set of people, and then also a different set of competitors, right? So that the same game in 1 year might get it, and the following year not, right?
Yeah. And so if we're talking about like, we want to make a game that's worthy of this title, or we want to make a game that people just can't ignore, you know, that when they see it, they're just like, oh my God, I have to have this, right? Well, we may not get to decide who sees it, right? But what we can do is try to make something that has enough emotional impact and resonance to it that when someone sees it, we elicit a response. And so there's certain things that we control, and that's where our goals need to be. And that is essentially, it's on the quality of the game, right? Mm-hmm. It's on the design, it's on the aesthetics, it's on the feel of and the vibe of the game. But our goals can't be player numbers or revenue targets or actually getting Game of the Year.
Mm-hmm. Right? Or even being well-received, right?
Yeah.
We can make a game that could be well-received. Right, that's the goal, right? But we can't control whether it is,
that's on everybody else.
Yeah, and I think that framing is really important, because it's easy to get frozen by the ambition of like what's supposed to happen, what you're trying to accomplish, right? Whether it's, and this is true at any level, right? Because we already know this is a commercial product. We already know, because Crashlands 2 is already out, that this thing is going to go into
Crashlands
systems, right? Yeah, sorry, Crashlands, original Crashlands.
Yeah.
and we also, already know who we're going to talk to see if we can get any platform deals. Like, we already know all of this stuff. So like, we kind of have a sense of like, yeah, Crashlands 2 is a game we're going to sell to people. That's going to happen, right? We don't know the level of success at all. We don't know what the reception will look like, but we know we're going to sell this game, which is very different than, if you're starting out, you're making a game, your first game or one of your first games, and exploring this idea of like what it means to make a commercial thing and so on, right? Where now everything is uncertainty and you're just like, can I sell this? Like, what's going to happen here, right? And in my focusing so much on the goal of selling the thing, or finding the target audience or whatever, all you're left with is things you don't control, you know? And so if you do the same thing, like nothing changes, just reframe the goal to be focused on the part that you do control, which is the thing that you make being the kind of thing, something that someone would buy, right? Being the kind of thing that's at a quality level and with an intended kind of market segment, sort of, right? Because again, you can't control who actually gets it or what market it falls into necessarily. But you know, like the kinds of stuff that people are into, you know? So if you're making something that is the kind of thing people are into, then that's the part you control. Mm-hmm. And so by focusing on that part, that also makes it so that the sting, when you then go launch it, of the parts you don't control, right, can go down. Because the fact is, you know, most games do not sell. Most things do not sell, period. Yeah. And that's not independent of, like the quality still has to be there, right? But the quality is not sufficient. It just is true that it's very hard to actually go from a thing that is worthy of success to that thing actually having success, right? Yep. And if you focus just on the worthiness part, right, and have that be the target,
then
that'd be
the goal. Then it's just about dice rolls.
After that, it's rolling dice. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think that's right. It can be really easy to just get hung up in those outcomes and trying to think of ways to do it. And I have spoken with people who have worked at companies or whatever, where, you know, the boss will come in and say, like, this year as a company, our revenue target is whatever, $15 million. And last year we made $10 million. And so this year we're really going to do 50% more money numbers. Mm-hmm. And then that's it. Like that's the goal, right? But then there's no conversation about process, about like, what are we changing to do that? Mm-hmm. And how do we make sure that we make that much? Right. Mm-hmm. Cause you can't.
Maybe you can, but then that should be the thing. Like if there's some input output relationship that your business has, where it's just like, more in here, we get 10% more out there. Right. Then you can, but that is the target, right? Like,
right. It's just add 10% more to your inputs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this idea of just like declaring what the outcome is going to be and then just kind of like carrying on is a very weird thing. I don't know. You guys have any final thoughts on that? I think it's an interesting way to think about stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's an important framing distinction, and it doesn't necessarily help with all the emotional problems that go into dealing with like you making a thing and trying to make it be successful.
Yeah, it's just hard.
It's just hard, and it doesn't. The goal of this kind of framing is one, just the realism that it's only reasonable to worry about things that you can control, but we're not reasonable as people because we're also emotional, right? So, but the idea is that by thinking about the stuff that you can reason through, that can help tamper the parts that you can't, which is your emotional responses to stuff. So it is important to constantly think about how you're framing things, because if you are framing things based on things you don't control, right? And if that's what you're reasoning about, then you can't possibly have a good emotional response to that, right?
Yeah. Because stuff is just going to happen now.
Stuff is just going to happen.
Sad about it. But I also think it's one kind of cool thing about this, though, is this idea of so for us, for Crashlands 2, we talked about our goal being a game that is hard, if not impossible, to ignore when you see it.
Yes.
Right? We see it and you're like, this thing stands out. It's one of a kind. It's beautiful. It's smooth. It looks inviting. I have to have it, right? And it's weird because you actually can kind of measure that. Mm-hmm. I think an interesting example is like this week, as I was working on the water, and I knew it wasn't there, because when I looked at it, I was like, It's just, I don't feel it. I don't feel anything, mm-hmm. but I'm looking at this water. And I just kept kind of tweaking it. And it wasn't actually until like we had kind of called the water like good enough. But then yesterday morning I was like, I got to try a few more things. And I did. And then I pushed it over and Sam started like building some terrain with it. And then he just goes, oh my God, this water is just amazing.
Yeah, it's just like, one of those things. There. Every so often it just hits you while you're, yeah. while you're doing stuff. Yeah. You're like, yeah.
Well, then, and then this morning, like as part of you just like waking up and getting about your day, you like specifically booted up the game on your phone, walked into a peninsula to be surrounded by as much water as possible. And then just looked at the water.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, there it is. And it, and the thing is like, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's going to make the game sell more copies. I don't know. I don't know if that's going to raise a critic's Metacritic score of the game.
You can't control
but
it.
But I know what the goal was, which was, you know, we're trying to make a world that feels amazing to be in. And you can feel that, right? So I can see what people's reactions are. And Sam actually had a similar thing when we were planning out the build mode stuff, which was this idea of having it so that if, as soon as you see something that's possible to build or like see the start of the build mode in Crash Ins 2, that you're just like, oh my God, I just want to build everything. Yep. And he was talking to, if you want to talk about this, Sam, when you're talking to Diana about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I run a lot of stuff by my wife because she has very clear emotional responses to things, which is just like my favorite. Like as far as a person who to give feedback, it's like the best. Especially
you know what she's you know what she's feeling.
Yeah, she's just like wow, it gets really excited, which is exactly what you want. And she also played a shitload of the original Crash Ins during the beta. I think she played like 80 hours of it or something like that. Like she was just glued to the damn thing. And base building was one of the big things for her. So she actually did all the. I mean, she usually doesn't like combat and stuff like that, but she did. She went through the whole game, like loved it, and then also built a sprawling like. Massive mega base in that thing. So using her as sort of your emotional test case for residents of a different build mode in the new game world is a kind of a useful thing. So I had sketched out basically the pieces and how this was going to kind of all be laid out. And it is different than the original. The original walls are a whole tile, which I always found kind of annoying because they're just so bulky. Like they're just gigantic.
They're like a short, bulky cylinder thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like they don't feel like walls very much because of their height. But then also the width is just so – it's just – they're so fat that like visually they just take up too much damn room. They don't leave a lot of room for all the other cool stuff, the actual stuff, right? And so
– Well, and to go back to that earlier discussion is because we started with the problem we started with was the world has to be tile-based and we don't want to have to solve the problem of what if a thing is smaller than a tile when it comes to collisions, right? Yeah. We started there and designed walls based on that.
Yeah, which you could do, right? But it's not necessarily designing for ideal emotional impact through the day. So in this case now, my proposal was basically these walls that are skinny, right? So they look more like actual fucking walls where they're not 700 feet thick by default. And I had mentioned this to my wife before I had actually drawn it up. And I had sort of the previous version of what the game would look like using the previous rules from original Crash Lands, which to me was just so heavy.
Because you're also trying to add height. Because we want to have there to be the feeling that there is a wall there. So there's actual height to it.
Yep.
And it's and as soon as you took those big ass blocky tiles and then pulled it up into like a pillar – yeah, it was outrageous. It looked like you were building a fortress.
They're just so huge. Yeah. It's just ridiculous. And but Diana's response was like, because it's the same as the original. So she was like, well, I mean, it's fine. You know, like, I think it's fine. I like the original. Yep. And I was like, I mean, I know, but I'm going to need you to just like.
But that's not the target.
Yeah, I'm going to have you come back like tomorrow and check on this. So I get the new one worked up and then I just like have her. Come look at it. And I was like, yeah, so here's what I'm thinking. And she's like, oh, she's like, I mean, I'm going to be building houses for like dozens of hours. And I was like, that's the response I want. Not like, it's fine.
It's fine. I can deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want you to deal. Like, I don't want anybody to be dealing with this. I want it to be the case that you just get, it just grabs you and you got to go do stuff now. But that's it. You know?
Yeah. And it's kind of like that feeling of, I remember when I was playing Kerbal Space Program and like, as you're slapping mm-hmm. your rocket parts together and sending them up, you know, it's just so fast and easy to just like tweak the rocket and try a new thing, you know, that you just kind of can't help but like, I'm like, well, around the time I first really started getting into it, like I would go to bed dreaming about rocket designs.
Yeah.
and they were all completely ludicrous and did not work at all. But I, like, it was all I could do to keep from like jumping out of bed and going and like trying it, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, that's the, it's not about like, I mean, it's fine. Like, that's not a good bar. No, that's not a good bar to hit. It needs to be just, yeah, it needs to be, it needs to have hooks. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. It's been an interesting week with Crash Bandicoot 2 stuff, really kind of digging into this build mode, water, environment design. It's been a lot of fun. So let's get on to questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from _Rompierbly, who says, let's daydream a bit. 10 years from now, Butterscotch Shenanigans has between 50 to 75 employees.
No thanks. Is this a day nightmare?
Yeah, what is this?
What kind of games would you want to be making with a studio that size? Would you be comfortable running a company that size someday? Well, no.
Nope. No thanks.
For starters, no. So I, you know, we've kind of gone back and forth about this question over the years. Well, what if we've gone back and forth between? I think we've gone back and forth between like the idea of thinking like, what would that be like?
Well, it's actually it's been about need, I think, more than anything, right? Because there's the conventional model out there, especially driven in the tech scene, because it's all startups and, you know, venture capital money and so on, people buying each other, all this kind of stuff, which is that the life cycle of a company is some founders get together. They have an idea. They figure out how to get it into action, and either they do it themselves or they find people to do it or they convince people to give them a fuckload of money or they bootstrap, whatever. But there's a whole process at that part, right? But then they start going, and then your metric of success is that suddenly you can't handle the thing that you've created, and the only way to handle it is to bring more people in. And the faster you've made a thing that you can't handle and need people to come help you handle, that's the marker of success. And like, and the more that accelerates and gets, like, I saw a series of just fascinating messages by this guy who started a company. It's called like Fast or something. I don't know what it is, but some web company. But they're like 18 months in, and they have 250 employees, right? And I was just looking at those two numbers, and I was like,
how?
What?
How can that be a good experience for anybody, right?
They've barely figured out what's even happening.
They don't know what's happening, right?
And they're like, trying to get 250 people all pointed in the same direction.
Yeah, and literally everybody in that company has been there, like statistically, has been there like less than 6 months, right? And we know that it takes 6 months to a year to like –
just to get started.
Just to get started, like to bring somebody in. But also if the company itself is shifting at the same time, like everything is happening at once, right? So I don't know. It just sounds horrible. But yeah, but the thing that we've always gone back and forth about is there's this idea out there that the marker of success is growth, right?
Growth in employee numbers.
In employee numbers specifically. But also that the goal is growth. Not just that the metric of success, but that by being successful – you get to be more successful by bringing in more people who in turn make you more successful. And this is now how you build upon success, is by growth, specifically through employing people, right? And so there's that model that is like the way you're supposed to do it, right? And also has this assumption out in there, built in there, that everybody is making, which is that more people is good, right? Mm-hmm. That if you have problems – you bring a person in to fix those problems. That if you have too much work, you bring in people to do that work, right? That's the core underpinning of this idea of growth. And this is also the battle that we've always had, which is like, oh, we don't have enough time, or like, oh, we need to add a QA department or whatever, right? It's, what does that next step look like? Do we hire an outside company to manage it for us? Do we bring on an employee and grow the team? Do we try to develop tools or buy tools that can do this for us? Like, what is the mm-hmm. what is the move there, right? And the gut reaction that we've always had every time there was something that was just like we just need to deal with was, do we need to grow the team? Like, do we need to hire somebody to do this? And I think what we've learned over the years is that is that, or I guess what I personally have kind of settled on is like my model of thinking about growth in terms of personnel is that growth of personnel basically means you tried literally everything else, right?
Yeah.
And that's now insufficient. So you're doing DevOps, you're investing in tools, you're doing all the kind of, you're buying tools from other people that do the work for you. You're focusing on quality. You're just doing all these other things because it's only when all of that isn't sufficient that you even can onboard somebody successfully, which is also because what we fucked up in the beginning, right?
Because what you're doing then is you're onboarding someone into an established high quality process
with clearly system.
With clearly stated goals and procedures.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the alternative,
as opposed to just throwing people at a problem, at a sort of an amorphous problem that you can't quite identify and hoping for the best.
Because that exacerbates the problem and it isn't setting somebody up for success. Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of, at least me personally, where like how I would sort of explain what I think about growth, which is that growth is a combination of, a failure in your ability to like to do the work that you're trying to do by any other means, coupled with the system in which that work has to happen being as good as you can possibly make it. It's like take those two things. And if you're in that scenario, that's the time when you can actually invest in the person. Because the fact is that adding people to your team is so fucking expensive. It is so fucking
and hard
costly.
And hard.
And now, yeah. and it's not just you add somebody to your team. It's like, ooh, we got 70 employees. Like, great. Now we can do, in our case, you know, 10x the amount of work that we were doing previously. It's like, no, most of the work now is managing the company, actually. Mm-hmm. And now you have to make something that's worth, because I also think about the cost of that. Like, what's the monthly burn rate?
Yep.
If you have 70 employees, right? $10 million? I don't know, something. It's a lot, whatever it is. Where the fuck is that money going to come from, right? Now all of a sudden we're just like, and the idea of, I guess, this daydream, right, is that, oh, now we have the money to do it. But if we have the money to do it, then just spend it all, then no, we don't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now we're just back on that treadmill again.
But there's also a question there, but what kind of experience would you be able to generate for people?
And yourself.
Well, not. I think that there's two different questions here. So one is like, what kind of games would you make with that kind of like firepower, right? So imagining the system scales up from what it currently is effectively and is like 75 people. One, the reality is like with just 6 people on our team, we do so much shit every week that if this was possible to fully scale up to like 70 people, I don't even know what would be happening, to be honest. Like –
you wouldn't know what was happening.
I just wouldn't know. It's like, that's like, because the amount of power that we have with just a few people is kind of dumb. So, like, I don't know.
That's kind of the fun of it, though, right? I'm in agreement with the idea that like growth is a last resort to get to your goals.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you should be, because if you're growing, then you're adding people into everything that you're already doing, and if the stuff that you're doing isn't working, then you're just adding people into a broken system.
Yeah, and now your costs are going way up with, and your incremental gains by adding people are basically and zero.
Yeah, so growth should be more about, well, it should be about expanding a working system that just needs more output. That's a thing.
So that adding a person truly actually adds output to that system.
Right, or it's about adding new capabilities, right? Yes. So in our case, it was like we knew that like QA was a big problem. We knew that business management was a problem. We knew that deployments were a problem, right? And we have people doing those things now. Mm-hmm. And those are departments that are constantly developing and working on their processes, but we're not growing them. We're not adding more people into them because we have the number of people that we need in order to refine the systems further.
Yeah. Well, and then the focus once we brought all those people on was on having each of them focus
work on the systems,
quality and on the systems so that the systems, so that, because there's always more work being added just constantly, right?
Yeah.
To all of those systems. And so by having people focus on how the work itself gets done and improving that, then it makes it so that they can manage more and more and more stuff, right, more and more effectively. So that if it does get to the case at some point where we say like, oh, but now that we have six games, we have this cycle where we try to keep them up to date, and we've exhausted everything that we can do technically with our build pipeline and with, you know, deployments and with QA and with all this kind of stuff. And the only possible move is to get another programmer in here to help build those systems or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Then yeah, at that point, that's what we're going to have to do, right? But that isn't – but there have been various points even just in the past couple of years where we're like, oh shit, do we need another Sure? You know, like, do we need another person in this role because like his workload was so intense? And but again, that comes with the assumption that adding a person will fix the problem.
Right. When in reality, we had a bunch of systemic and process-related things going on that
needed to do. And historical ones, right? Because like a lot of what was consuming his time. This is another important thing in the games industry, is that because you're on a product release cycle, that your needs and like what's really important when and what's on a bottleneck when and all that kind of stuff changes sort of month by month. And
it's very cyclical.
It's very cyclical, and it's really easy while you're in the frenzy of a particular resource just being fucking bottlenecked and like just unavailable to think, oh God, we need to add a person to this, right? Only to find, you know, 2 months later, that person's not the bottleneck anymore. What were you going to do with two people? You know, like once you had them. And every time we've had this discussion, it's always been when somebody was drowning, right? But the reason for that person drowning was almost always the end result of some series of systemic or historical failures.
Yeah, and adding a new person in there would require that person who is currently overworked to train someone.
Yeah, and that person added won't even be useful for another 6 months or a year.
Yeah, by which point the problem has passed, and now you've got two people problem. with nothing to do. So
yeah, and they've got the feed the beast problem, right? Which is now you need something for those people to do. So now they generate more work, and now they generate more problems, and now they're doing this inside of a broken system, and so now the system gets even more broken. And oh, better hire somebody else now to help fix this, right? And so,
I think this is where there's a big gap. Do they call it like the chasm or something like that? That's like known in both startup and small businesses, where it's relatively easy to get the first bit of sort of sustainable growth out of your company, and then a lot of companies die in this sort of like there's a valley between that and like bigger success. And when you look at why, it's because of the growth problem. Which is that most companies try to solve their problems in this particular way, by hiring people, which is, as we've talked about, expensive in every way, not just in terms of money, but expensive in terms of overall production, stuff like that. And most businesses don't have clear enough processes and pipelines in place to make it truly the case that when they hire someone, they're hiring the right person. I mean, we didn't, frankly, early on. And it's so hard to figure out that's where most companies like you get that first bit, right? We're like, yeah, adding one person when you only have one person is generally good because like there's so much shit to do, right? But it is the case that as you kind of scale this stuff up, the marginal you start getting some marginal returns on.
Well, it's the complexity of scaling is exponential.
Yes.
Right. Because the impact of adding a person is now that person can interact with all other people and all systems, right? And vice versa. So all systems now are affected by the fact that person now exists. And so every person you add now has that times the number of people and systems that are already there, number of dimensionality in which they change the complexity of the system, right? And so adding one person, like you added one connection. That's all that's happened, right? You add two people, now there's three connections. I think it's actually geometric growth, whatever the hell it is, right? But it just starts to grow really, really fast. And even going from one to two people is very hard, right? Because it's the moment you add that management layer of having to figure out like
– You got to communicate.
You got to communicate. Because the fact is like we made original Crashlands without any systems, right? Because we just relied on the fact that we all had exactly the same goals. We all have exactly the same incentives. We all knew what we were all trying to do. And then we got away with having no systems, right? The moment we started to add people, all of a sudden, like, they needed to know why we were doing things. Their incentives weren't the same as ours because they're not running the company, right? We're guaranteed to be in this for the long haul. But people we hire, like, their careers could be whatever they want them to be, right? So, like,
they don't need to stick around. Yeah.
Yeah, we hope they stick around. I guess we probably hope they stick around, depending on what happens, right? but yeah, like things aren't the same, right? And like even our way of doing work, it's like now all of a sudden we have to think like, oh, because in the past we just like, we all love to work, so we didn't even worry about it. We're just like, oh yeah, we'll just all work. What's the problem, right? And now all of a sudden you have to be like, oh no, we need to be like, we need to make it clear that like what the work week looks like. And and like, what does it mean to like take time off or take a break or whatever? Like all of a sudden stuff that we just took for granted is just like, we're not even worrying about this because we know we're all invested into
the stuff that you never had conversations about before.
Yeah. There's no systems, right? So and that was where we fucked up the first time is we didn't realize that we didn't have systems. We just didn't, it wasn't a thing we even just identified as a problem, right? Until we brought new people in who didn't have the same enormous set of assumptions that we had, were all implicit, right? And all of a sudden, like everything had to become explicit and the shape of the work had to change. And the question of like, how did we know what we were supposed to do? Right? Like,
I do really like that framing though, basically saying like growth is a last resort to accomplish your goals. Because it is the worst possible option.
it's the worst way to solve your problems.
It's the worst way to solve. It's the worst, most expensive, hardest way to solve your problems. So
do you need to be every very clear other about it, basically, right?
Yeah, do every other thing first. Get your house in order.
Yep. The idea of us scaling up to like 70 people, I think it's just. I mean if that were to happen, I see that happening on the order of like 50 years. You know what I mean? Like just right. One person every year and a half or two, just slowly.
Well, and I think there are – I think it's like if our goal was to say like be a self-contained like publishing house, you know, where we wanted it as an entity, be just like spitting out games and we wanted to like establish a practice, a way of doing things, right? And establish an IP that has lots of different things in it, right? I could see basically if that was a model, right? Like, yeah, we absolutely cannot make five games at once with our team, right?
Correct.
If we wanted as a company to be able to make five games at once, then growth is the only way to do that. But the question is, how would that work, right? And the way that would work is that we would have to be so fucking confident in our systems that we've established making one game at a time that we believe
we could train up a new team.
That we could train up a new team to start doing that. And then they could do the same and then we could start, you know, building a system that way. We'd have to have a very clear, but the goal there again, it wouldn't be growth. It would be specifically to say, like, we want to make more games. And that is bottlenecked. There's no way around the fact that we can't make two
games.
One
at a time. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. And again, there's no guarantees there. Cause like Sam was talking about, that could destroy the studio. Because if we add an entire new team of people, that's a big jump in burn rate. And just because we are now making two games in parallel, which now have their own launch costs, their own release cycle, whatever, there's no guarantees that pays off.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one guarantee, especially with the first time you ever do this, and apparently this is also a thing, like studios that go from making one game to two games, like that's the hard jump because your guarantee is actually probably – that you're going to make both games worse than you made the last one.
And slower.
Slower.
Yeah. So it's more likely that, you know, the move would have to be like bring in a new group of people, but actually have them join the production process on the current game in production, work on parts of that game, be totally integrated in the process for like a couple of years. Right. Then they can spin off. But at that point, then you're like, well, we figured out how to take this group of now like, you know, six developers or whatever, all working on the same game. We figured out a bunch of systems with that. Now we're just going to, again, just make a game with this larger team and not make two games at the same time, right? Because that's what we figured out how to do. And it's a risk to break it apart now. So I don't know. It's hard.
I think the thing we settled on is the conclusion that it's all a treadmill. Right?
Yes.
Because you can add somebody else to the team. Yeah, absolutely. To generate something else, right? Assuming that you've done a good enough job that adding a person to your team truly does that. But people are not solution. They're not just people and tools. They don't just create solutions. They change the shape of the problem, right? Mm-hmm. And if they're coming in with a solution, that means they're making some problem easier, right? Which means you get to do more of that thing. Up until the point where you break back even, which is Jevons' paradox, right? Is you improve a system and therefore you use the system more, and now you're back at square one, maybe with more throughput, right? So if that throughput is valuable enough, then like the end result is good.
Good. Yeah.
But there's never a situation that where you're just like, oh yeah, like I figured out how to like run a company where, you know, I'm just not involved. It's like it's just running itself. We're just games. Like every time we add a new person, we just make games 5% faster or whatever. Like, or I guess one over the number of people percent faster. Yep. Right? It's like, and we just got it all figured out. And it's going. It's like, no. It's if we doubled the size of our team, our games would just become twice as complex, right? Or take twice as long to make, or be twice
or longer
as big,
than twice as long.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And longer. Yeah, because it's not a perfect efficiency. And so, and the end result of that is what is okay. Well, is it the case that a game that is twice as complex or twice as big or whatever will make twice as much money?
Has greater success potential?
No, probably not. So what are we actually accomplishing by doing this, right? There's only one dimension along which I see growth besides just like foundational to like keep things running and to solve the back catalog, the ever-growing back catalog of problems, which is that we have games to maintain, right?
Yeah.
And every time we finish a game and launch it, we got to maintain that one too now, right? And so that's the one scenario where I can – that's like very obvious to me, like over time we're going to have to add people to deal with. Same deal with QA. As our games get more successful and better and we have more players, then there's now customer management stuff too that we mostly don't have to deal with at the moment. So there are like these kinds of pieces of it that I can see definitely needing to expand with a direct like – once we've, again, shored up the systems, now there's a direct benefit to adding those people. But as soon as we're talking about adding people to help build the product, right, then now we don't actually know if that's worth it. And we can't know ever, even once we have done it and launched some games. We will never know if that was the right move, right? And I think that's the really important thing about how you're thinking about it is like is increasing production actually linearly correlated with the outcome? And And this is, we're talking about games here, right? Because there are some things where, yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, if there's a one-to-one relationship,
and you just need more pasta making machines and more people running those machines, and you're going to, and the demand is there, which I mean, maybe
that's also required.
But,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are some scenarios where that's true, but games is not one of those scenarios. No. There's not a tight relationship between what your game is and how well it can do in a market.
Or rather, the cost of your game.
Yeah, the cost
of producing your game.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's complicated. So I guess to answer then the question of what would we do?
Sell the company immediately and get the fuck out of there. That's what I'd do.
Just run for the hills. That's what I'd do. So that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.